Pardon me for interrupting lunch, but we're now ready for our keynote luncheon speaker, Susan Eisenhower. Susan Eisenhower is president of the Eisenhower Group, which provides strategic counsel on political, business, and public affairs projects. And she's the former president, current chairman emeritus of the Eisenhower Institute. That's the think tank with offices both here in Washington and on the campus of Gettysburg College. Susan has written extensively both on energy policy issues and on their intersection with issues of national security and nuclear non-proliferation, especially as involving the nations of the former Soviet Union. She serves as a fellow of the International Peace and Security Program of the Carnegie Corporation of New York and as a member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute for 21st Century Energy. Just more recently, she's been named to the External Advisory Board of MIT's Energy Initiative. She'll reflect today on what we can apply from the success of the Eisenhower administration's Interstate Highway Program as we consider how best to forge a true national electricity grid. Please join me in welcoming Susan Eisenhower.
Thank you very much for that nice introduction, and what a pleasure it is to be here today. My thanks to everyone at the Manhattan Institute for making this opportunity possible. I must say, you're here in Washington, folks from New York, at a very, very interesting time. I think in next month we're going to have a series of rallies on the Mall. One of them is going to be hosted by Stephen Colbert. He's going to be out there saying, let's keep fear alive. And I love that idea. I think so many of us have gotten a big kick out of that, because what Stephen Colbert has done is put his finger on something very important, which is if we can't laugh about the state in which we find ourselves, then we're in trouble. And the state in which we find ourselves is a kind of national sense that we can't do anything anymore. I think this is a principal worry that I'm concerned about, that the mood, in fact, in this city and across the country is one of perplexity, one of inaction in some sense, and some tremendous worry that we can't move forward. Now, I'd like to approach today as a strategist, and in that context also note that I think that we are on an issue like the building out the grid and modernizing the grid in a state where a number of cultural factors come together. Not only do we seem fearful in the wake of this economic crisis, but we also have big strains in our society that are against government. This notion that the government shouldn't be involved in anything is really a very curious one for me when we think of the things we're really proud of. We are proud of the interstate highway system. We're proud of the fact that we got through the Cold War without difficulty, but we did so with a great national consensus revolving what our strategy was going to be for meeting that challenge. And at the same time, we've become rather spoiled and indulgent while all these other factors are in play. That is, we take things for granted. And among the things we take for granted is the fact that when you flip the switch, electricity is going to fire up your electric lights or your electronic devices. As a matter of fact, one of my friends once said that the difference between the telephone system and the electrical system is that with the electrical system, no one will accept a busy signal. This is very true. In any case, as a strategist, I would look back at this and be reminded of my own personal mentor, how fortunate I was to spend 12 years in an office next to Andrew J. Goodpaster, four-star general, commander of NATO, the man who went back and saved the U.S. Military Academy just after the cheating scandals. And he worked for George Marshall. He also worked for Dwight Eisenhower. And during those 12 years, I got a lot of lessons that came from an earlier generation. He used to say that there are only several long poles in the tent. And as a strategist, this is the way you have to think. What are the long poles in the tent? What would be the consequences if one of the long poles, or if the longest pole indeed, were to fall away? All else would collapse. Now, in thinking about national security, I guess we could debate whether or not our struggle in the war against terrorism is clearly a long pole, but is it the longest pole? I'd submit at the end of the day that electricity, or energy in general, is the longest pole in the tent. We can't operate a military. We can't operate a Department of Homeland Security. We don't have a viable economy. We can't function as a nation without energy and the electricity that is created by that. Critical, I think, by the way, and this is in parentheses, I think we have to do a much better job of integrating the debate that goes on in this city on energy with the transmission question. And we had some wonderful presentations this morning that made that point very strongly. In any case, I don't need to go into the background for you. We had so many good presentations this morning. But I will say that as a strategist, and as a strategist who accepts the idea that energy and electricity is the long pole in the tent, we have to remember that in the last 30 years, over 85% of the growth in the U.S. energy demand has been supplied by electricity. And if I were a strategist looking at this issue, I would be deeply, deeply concerned about the fact that our energy supply is operating nearly at capacity. We take this electricity for granted, but indeed the grid is in trouble. I think with respect to U.S. capacity requirements, it was pretty alarming to read in the study 2007 long-term reliability assessment that NERC came to the disturbing conclusion that our long-term capacity margins on the nation's transmission systems are inadequate to protect these systems from interruptions such as brownouts or blackouts. Let me just take another parenthetical moment here to tell you that I know what happens when there are brownouts and blackouts. In addition to the fact that I was on the 14th floor of a hotel in New York City in August of 2003 when so much of the East Coast went out, I can tell you that earlier in the 1970s, I lived in Great Britain during times of great domestic turmoil, and the coal miners went on strike. And so for three successive winters, we had blackouts of 3, 6, and 9 hours a day. If you don't know what it's like to live in a society that does not have electricity available on a ready basis, then I'll meet you out in the corridor afterwards and tell you some of the hair-raising stories from that period, where not only did no electronics work, though that would have been largely a television back in those days, stoplights didn't work in downtown London. It was absolute chaos. Again, I could spend most of my presentation telling you about what happened to the economy in Great Britain during that time. And why couldn't they solve the problem? There was a national malaise that kept them. It took a good solid 10 years before Great Britain got itself back on its feet from those periods during the 70s. So I'm concerned when I read this NERC study that says that our transmission systems are inadequate to protect from interruptions such as brownouts and blackouts. But they go on to say, the capacity margins will fall below acceptable levels by 2010, and that the situation may become critical by 2013. I find it amazing that we're having an internal discussion here, talking about how to excite the federal government about the electrical grid when we've got these facts in front of us. As I said, it's not just the economy that operates. Our whole national security infrastructure relies on our national grid. And so I guess I've posed most of this mostly in the challenge direction, but there are great opportunities as well. As we've heard today, the incredible efficiencies that will be realized throughout the system is a significant part of the reason we should care. In addition to this, it's not only the exercise of our own economic potential that's important, but we have fierce competitors overseas who already get this. I know that there are people in this room who've actually seen the 1,000 kilovolt project in China. This is actually a recognition on the Chinese part that they cannot be a great economic power without a modern transmission system. Maybe this is the time to reflect on the interstate highway system for a second, because I think the interstate highway system tells us many things, most important, that a big national project is doable. I think the reasons to talk about the interstate highway revolve around two things. As I said, that such a big national project is doable, but even more important, the interstate highway system, whether it's exactly correct with respect to modernizing the grid or not, is accurate. The truth is it's an analogy that people can understand. Everybody gets on the interstate highway system to go visit their aunts and grandparents, et cetera. But it's something they understand. They're on-ramps, they're off-ramps, they're state roads, they're federal roads. It's an analogy that people get. I was once asked about what's the difference between a transmission grid and a smart grid. And I said, well, think of the smart grid as your driveway. You know, it's just something that people can clearly understand. But truthfully, there's really a rather rich story behind the interstate highway system that gets to my earlier point about the transmission grid being a national security concern. It's not an accident that the National Highway Defense System Act has the word defense in it. And it's not an accident that maybe it took a five-star general to get a big project like this off the ground. It was, for its time, the largest infrastructure project in the history of this country. And he was used to doing things for the first time, including the invasion of Normandy and the first Civil Rights Act and a few other things. So, but he approached this as a strategist and understood absolutely the strategic nature of a highway system. So every time I say highway, think grid, okay? There were two formative moments for him on this. Well, I'm sure there were many formative moments, but the two key ones were, first of all, a trip he took out west as a young man. Not long after his graduation from West Point, he was assigned to take a truck convoy from the Ellipse here in Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, California. I don't know if anyone wants to raise a hand and hazard a guess at how long that took. But it took, I'll save you all the problem, it took over 2 months to get from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, California. And they, I mean, it's an amazing story. How many times vehicles broke down, how many disasters they had, how many bridges collapsed. And all of this made an enormous impression on this young Army officer and his colleagues. Extended trips, Eisenhower said, by trucks through the Midwest of the United States were flat out impractical. Then, fast forward to World War II, this young officer becomes the general in charge of the Allied invasion forces, and one of the central areas of concern for the Allies in invading the heart of Germany was to gain control over the Autobahn system. It is not an accident that a five-star general understood the importance of actually having large connective swaths of this country that would make it possible to defend the homeland. Struggle as they did, we gained control over those Autobahns, and it's not an accident that 10 years later, literally 10 years later in 1955, Eisenhower puts the power of his presidency behind an interstate highway system. I think it's a rather extraordinary fact, actually, that this was sold to the American people as a dual-use idea, that not only would it have national security implications, but this was a period when America felt like it could do anything it wanted to do and needed to do, because after World War II, we burst onto the scene as the world's great and only standing power, and it was going to be our challenge to create a modern system that would make it possible to realize this opportunity. And so I think it's rather interesting that there was a decision to make a federal interstate highway system. It did nothing to diminish the importance of state highways, state and local roads. But having said that, the federal government understood that this was something that was going to be a national project. It would tie together disparate sections of the United States. It would create a kind of national cohesion. And so it was primarily federal responsibility to take this on. The original authorization of $25 billion was for the construction of 41,000 miles of interstate highway system over a 20-year period. The way it was constructed was that 90% of the construction costs were going to be assumed by the federal government and 10% by the states. It was expected that the money would be generated through new taxes on fuel, automobiles, trucks, and tires. Those are back in the days when you could talk about new taxes. But still, this highway trust fund not only provided a way for the interstate highway system to be funded, it went on to be extended as a fund to include mass transit. Rather interesting that the money that was raised through this trust fund it emanates from a percentage tax on gasoline, and this is something that we're absolutely accustomed to paying. Now, in terms of the interstate highway system serving as this rather interesting hybrid of both meeting our national security objectives and also our economic objectives, you might think that perhaps the interstate highway was never used for national security reasons. You might be surprised to know, though I should say very quickly, that the interstate highway system carries specifications that are reflected in the way military equipment and personnel are organized. Military equipment is, in fact, designed to be moved along the interstate by its size and capacity. And the interstate was also devised to encompass emergency evacuation procedures. And so it's probably not surprising. We didn't land aircraft, but on 9/11, the interstate highway played an indispensable role in delivering the critical piece of equipment to get to ground zero, to make it possible to cut through the 1 million-ton pile of steel, glass, and concrete. They managed to do this in about 24 hours because of this interstate highway system. Since the equipment was coming from the Midwest, it was a 345 ultra-high demolition machine that was developed by Caterpillar. And if it had been Dwight Eisenhower's highway of 1915, one can only imagine how long it would have taken to get that piece of equipment to New York. I hope you're still thinking electrical grid as I'm telling you highway stories here. In any case, that's an example of how indispensable. Maybe we don't always like the development that lines these highways, but certainly that has been our ongoing choice. It's hard to imagine America today without an interstate highway system, and it's hard to imagine America without a robust electrical grid that provides the energy, the critical energy we're going to need as we go forward. Make no mistake about it, electrical demand may be down right now because of the recession, but when a number of very, very important elements come online, such as I hope the movement towards electrification of vehicles, this is going to solve one of our big transportation questions, but also the sheer demand that all of us place on the system every day through our electronic gadgets and others. We're going to need electricity like we never needed it before. So let me close by saying that we have to think about this particular issue in an entirely different way. I thought the conversation this morning about cost allocation was absolutely fascinating because, again, it's indicative of the cultural times in which we live, where everybody's trying to figure out what exactly their cost is, and they don't want anybody else to benefit from something, you know, if they have to pay for it. But it completely misses the point of what we managed to do during the Cold War and what we have to do today. We have to stop thinking about fairness, individual fairness, and start thinking more about national progress. Other countries in the world are doing this, and this today is our challenge. Because of a coherent national strategy, we managed to get through the Cold War and to prevail. Today, we have a different set of problems. They revolve around economic competition. They revolve around the challenge to American global leadership. They revolve around our capacity to retain and expand our economic prowess, and they are going to test our capacities as a nation to address our collective needs. So let me close by saying, please think about the long poles in the tent. As a community, let's try and think about reframing this issue to underscore the fact that small details about how we organize, who pays, and who has the authority, this is tactical detail. This is a long pole in the tent. It is the longest pole in the tent, and this will do much to decide our future. Thank you very much.
take some questions. I'll start it off. Since I put everybody else on the spot, I can't spare you.
Okay, well, please, absolutely.
National security. Some might worry that an interconnected grid would be vulnerable to sabotage, terrorist attack. Do you worry about that?
Well, first of all, don't we have an interconnected grid right now? I mean, it may not be interconnected in a way that feels very modern or helps us sleep better at night because we know that when we flip the switch, the electricity is going to go on, but we have an interconnected grid. I think the real challenge, because we're now beginning to think about modernization, expansion, possibly a backbone grid that will provide a real interstate highway system for electricity, any configuration in which you wish to discuss that is, you know, I wouldn't call it on the drawing board, but we're beginning to think about it. But when we think about it incrementally, which was said this morning, let's make sure that we don't box ourselves in for the long term by taking short-term steps that seem convenient and doable. We have to have a national way of looking at this issue. One part of the country to do better than another part of the country does not do the United States of America the kind of job that it needs to be done. So while we're thinking about this, I'm sure that redundancy within the system as we expand and modernize, ways to address those engineering concerns can be put on the table right now. But we have to, you know, we have been drawing down on the legacy of our parents and grandparents for more than a generation, and we should be able to do this. We are proud of our military. The government runs our military. The government knows how to allocate resources to get a job done. And we need, if we were to think about energy in the same way, that's not only transmission but also generation. And to see these interconnected pieces and what we need and how to go about it, I think we'll get a lot farther. Could I add one more thing to this? Is that I think we need to start finding new allies in Congress. Because this is a very powerful issue, especially what I heard this morning, which was really, it's really thrilling, Peter, when you put those numbers on the table about what kind of efficiencies this will bring, that there are more efficiencies in having a modernized grid than there are in all of the personal and individual measures we're going to be taking. So we need to excite the public about the opportunity to enhance our national security and our economic security in one fell swoop by taking a strategic look at this rather than a tactical one.
Great. A couple more questions. There's another handheld mic out here, so I'm not going to give it back. Other questions for Susan?
Terrible when I've already spoken, but there is, as I'm sure you know, a school of thought among the Greens, in fact, a very influential piece written about 40 years ago saying that the grid is brittle and that it is a source of our weakness, and in fact, that I mean, it was published in Foreign Affairs at the time. Now, I think they're dead wrong, but it is a big political challenge. Now, to my mind, and since I didn't get to say this morning, along the lines you're discussing, this is one of the very few issues where we're actually seeing some convergence now, I think, between the green left, if I may say, and whatever the rest of us are, okay? And it's very heartening. I mean, you've got the World Wildlife Fund writing a major report saying big central power plants are efficient. They are lower carbon footprint and so on. And if there's any political coalition we ought to be able to forge here, it's right here.
Peter, thank you for that comment. Actually, this gives me an opportunity to voice some concern about the way this debate is shaping up. I think that there is a significant consensus about the importance of seeking the efficiencies in a modernized grid, but I'm not sure everybody is, you know, fully prepared for this. You have some segments of the energy stroke environmental community that are afraid they'll be coal by wire, or as you say, on the other side there would be windmill by wire, or I don't know what, whatever by wire. I just want to, again, this interstate highway system analogy is rather fun. I heard somebody say at a conference, I thought it was brilliant, and I try and use it all the time, which is, this would be like building an interstate highway system for organic vegetables only. I mean, this is the reason the whole notion that what kind of electrons, how the electrons were generated before they can go into a grid. The reason that has potency is because every advocate for a certain approach is allowed an equal voice. And the reason, first of all, we should hear from them all, but on top of all that needs to be a strategic framework. In the national security field, we have Ambassador Tom Graham back here. I'm delighted to see him. He and I have worked very hard on national security issues over many years. There's always a framework, an intellectual framework that's overlaid any military decisions. We need to do this with energy. We shouldn't have winners and losers, and we shouldn't feel emotional about, technology. We should feel emotional about being Americans and getting it right. And we need to stand back and think about when some of this new technology is going to be online, what the cost is going to be, how can you sequence this to meet the coming demand, how can you mitigate effects on the environment, and how are you going to get it to the consumer? And this is all part of a big package that needs to be thought of in a strategic way. I think if this were elevated in a strategic national security kind of way, you'd get much more interest in Congress, because people thinking about national security and meeting our big tent obligations is something that has always had a lot of appeal on Capitol Hill, because it gets to us where we feel most strongly as Americans, and that is our patriotism and our desire to meet the needs of our country as a whole. If we have allowed ourselves to be engaged in bickering and unworthy name-calling around critical issues, it's only because we need reassurance that we can do this. And that's why the interstate highway system's rather fun. It was not a picnic in 1955. You remember Joe McCarthy just left the scene, and this country was not in psychologically best of shape. But there was a sense that the country's on the move, that we've got a big challenge and a big responsibility globally, because the Cold War was well underway and World War II was over and we were the only power standing. And there was that sense that we have an obligation not only to ourselves but to the world. Nothing's changed. This is just as an exciting a time as that can be, but it's up to us to drive this home at the highest levels with the most important a framework that makes it possible for people to see how doable it really is.
Please join me in thanking Susan Eisenhower.
I think it is clear how fortunate we are
to believe in the power of ideas.
Supply the common sense and the fresh thinking of the Manhattan Institute.